Bill 5035, the Public Employees Retirement System, and Legislative Fiscal Officer Dallas will give us an overview.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Public Employees Retirement System, budget request is ready to be heard today. I have handed out to each of you a memorandum that I delivered to the chair laying out a schedule for this week. Also, you have the write-up from that we customarily do in the governor's budget request. And there's a copy of an audit report done by the Secretary of State Audit Division that kind of well-publicized about its computer system, the existing retirement information management system.
And ours looks like this, right?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yours is a Xerox copy of the entire report. When we get copies from Secretary of State, if they don't have them bound, they make copies for us with a three-hole punch. There are a number of program option packages contained in this budget, so you see that we've scheduled about 2 days for the detailed review of the budget request. One of the packages is, of course, the ongoing reengineering and system development known as the Oregon Pension Administration System. The memo indicates that Representative Hill's subcommittee is not yet ready to hear that portion of it. So right now, as it stands, the recommendation is just to have the public hearings and we'll be ready to go to work session after Representative Hill's subcommittee has heard that portion of it, so we can do all of the budget at one time. So it should be, there is a lot to cover in this agency. You know, it gets a lot of publicity and it has a lot of responsibilities. Much of its budget is non-limited, which is the payment of benefits. The portion that we have responsibility for is its operations, or the limited portion of the budget request. We have with us today the Executive Director, Mr. Voitko, and the Chair of the Board, Emil Holman, who came forward today. As you remember, the Audit Committee had some concerns this last interim and sent memos to the co-chairs of Ways and Means, as well as to leadership, about oversight exercised by boards that appoint directors. So we have asked the agency to bring the board member here, and he's here to answer questions also, at least today, I believe, to the overview. So with that,
Okay, then we'll have the agency overview with Mr. Holman and Mr. Voitko. Sorry if I mispronounced.
Sarah Gates is the budget management analyst.
Good morning, Sarah. If you'll introduce yourself for the record, and then are we going to be in this document? Whoever starts first, is that correct? Is this your document, Sarah?
I have, Madam Chair, I'm Emil Holman.
Good morning.
Chair, members of the committee, we have a prepared document.
Thank you.
I think that I'd like to use as a basis for discussion this morning. As I mentioned, my name is Emil Holman, and I'm the current chair of the Public Employee Retirement System Board of Trustees. I wanted to visit with you a little bit this morning about a little bit about myself, I guess, to begin the discussion. I am a lifelong member of a resident of Pendleton, and I have been operated a small business in Pendleton for 35 years, and in 1990, I became interested in pursuing a county commissioner's position that became open, and developed a campaign and ran for that position, was elected in the fall of 1990 and took office in 1991. And currently, I'm in my 11th year as a county commissioner from Umatilla County, Oregon. So that gives you a little bit of background about me. During my 35-year career in business in Pendleton, I also participated as a member of the Pendleton City Council and a brief tenure on the Pendleton School District 16R Board of Trustees. So I have a little bit of background in fiscal management and have had some experience along those lines. I wanted to speak a little bit about the composition of the Public Employee Retirement Board members. I think, as a lot of you know, there are 11 members on the board. Four of those memberships come from the collective bargaining arena, and four are from management. One of the eight must be a retiree, and the other three positions are from the private industry side. The terms that are a three-year term, and all appointments are by the governor and with confirmation by the Senate, as I'm sure you're aware. I wanted to share with the committee some of the vocations of some of the board members to give you an idea of their set of skills. We have a school superintendent, a firefighter, an Oregon vocational rehab employee, an Oregon agency director, and a former member of the Justice Department, a city planner, a private sector attorney, a business executive, a retired educator, a city councilman, an insurance company executive, and of course a county commissioner. And for a volunteer board, I think this is an unusual mix of talent and skills. The governor's executive committees that appoint people to these boards, I think, have done an outstanding job in terms of giving representation to the PERS board that really covers a wide range of skills and experience. We also have some gender balance. We have 5 females and 6 males on the board. And we have a bit of geographical balance also. We began in the southern part of the Willamette Valley in Eugene, Springfield, and go to the Albany area, Salem, Kaiser, Tualatin, Milwaukee, Portland area. And of course, two of the members are from Pendleton, which really adds a lot of strength and class to the.
All right.
It's been a wonderful experience being having a small role on this very wonderful organization. I was appointed to the Public Employee Retirement Board in the fall of 1992, and in the fall of 2001, I will end my term with the board. It's been a wonderful experience for me, and one that I'm very proud of. I wanted to go over a few of the responsibilities that the board deals with on a regular basis. In the fiduciary area, we administer the trust in the best interest of all membership and participants. We certainly protect the trust funds from diversion to other uses. We advise the legislature so that it may fulfill its fiduciary responsibility to trust members and certainly maintain sound funding policies. Another overriding responsibility of the board is to, when the position comes open, is to fill the director's position. He works directly for the Board of Trustees. As you may recall, Fred McDonald, the former executive director for the association, retired or announced his retirement in 1999, and immediately the PERS board was faced with the daunting task of finding a suitable director to take Mr. McDonald's place. The Department of Administrative Services was so very helpful in that process by providing the necessary background, advertising, and expertise to attract a very strong field of candidates for the position. And the result of all that effort with the Department of Administrative Services and the board was the gentleman sitting on my right, Mr. Voitko. Mr. Voitko came to the system in, I believe, in February of 2000, and I honestly don't think that he stopped running since that time. It's been a real challenge for the new director to lead this organization, and I would say that he's done an outstanding job to date, and we're very pleased with Mr. Voitko's efforts. Some additional responsibilities of the board, some of our actuarial duties would include working through our actuarial services committee. We do most of our work by committee. We also hire an actuary and certainly prepare requests for proposals in that process. We do that about every 2 to 4 years to test what's out there in the real world for us and to, I guess, assure ourselves that the current actuary is doing his job as we feel is adequate and appropriate. We adopt actuarial assumptions and methods, and certainly another big portion is to establish employer rates. We also implement the PERS plan in accordance with legislation, the Oregon Revised Statutes, Chapters 237, 238, and 293. Additionally, we adopt administrative rules. We set standards not defined in statute and maintain tax qualification status of our trusts. Some additional responsibilities would include under financial and control, the board, audit, and budget committee. This committee meets quite frequently. Actually, we're scheduled to meet quarterly, but as the workload demands, they're available as needed. We receive excellent support from staff and management and actually make every attempt to get into a great deal of detail with the review of our rather complex budget. It probably doesn't seem that way to you folks. It does for us. It's quite an interesting prospect whenever we get into that. It's quite extensive. The Board Audit and Budget Committee reviews and recommends those agency budgets, certainly monitors internal and external audit activity, and then submits their findings to the full board. And again, at that time, we have a full discussion amongst staff and management and go on from that point. The full board reviews and approves the budgets recommended by the Audit and Budget Committee. We also establish earnings crediting policies. We credit available earnings to members and other reserves, and we also fund statutory reserves as needed. The nuts and bolts of our overview by the full board is in the committee structure. As I mentioned earlier, the committees are formed and appointed by the chair, and we try to represent all the interest groups that are prevalent across the board, are the internal organization of our board, all the various interest groups. We try to break that down so that each committee has a representative on each committee. We have a health insurance committee that meets quarterly, a legislation committee that meets monthly, and oftener when needed, an investment oversight committee, which is scheduled monthly. We have the audit and budget committee quarterly, and our actuary services committee meets as needed. A few of the challenges that are being addressed by the board currently. We have a huge concern about the approaching retirement of baby boomers. I think all of you are quite aware that the aging workforce across the state of Oregon in the next 10 to 15 years is contemplated to be retiring in very large numbers, and we see that as being a real challenge for the retirement system, which creates a necessity for having the right kind of tools and equipment to meet that demanding workload that will be placed on all the employees in the retirement system. That certainly is one of the challenges. We're operating in a dynamic regulatory environment. The board has, seems like we've, in the last year or so, perhaps a little longer than that, have had an ever-increasing demand on board's time to hear contested cases in our system, disabilities and other problems that come through the system. It seemed like there's been a greater emphasis on the part of the membership to challenge contested cases, and the board acts as the final appeal before they go to the court system. So that has taken quite a lot of additional time for board members. Meetings have been extended as a result of having to deal with as many extended and contested cases as we've had in the recent past, and it looks like that will be with us for some time. Additional challenges are the increasing obsolescence of the Retirement Information Management System. I think you're probably all familiar with that if you read through your budget documents, that we just don't have the computer capabilities to keep up with the system that we currently have. It's come to the near the end of its useful life cycle. We're hoping that we can generate the necessary support to continue our new OPUS project that we see as one way to address the future needs of the retirement system and provide the high level of services that all our members have come to expect. We also have fiscal and operational issues related to the sudden prominence of money match. I think you're all aware that there's a lot of concern across the system about some of the final retirements are exceeding their three-year average. That's not the rule, but it does happen occasionally. And other symptoms like that seem to add to the cost of the system. We're very concerned about all of that and want to do everything within reason to correct that as best we can. Several major board initiatives would include to re-engineer organization and systems to meet the growing service needs of the aging baby boomers, which I've touched on briefly, to provide increased flexibility to address internal and external events, things that are out of our control, and certainly to replace an obsolete pension computer system. Other major initiatives would include conducting actuarial audit, or it was a major initiative that we conducted an actuarial audit of the 1999 valuation, which initiated changes for future valuation. I think that was a service that was beneficial and long-term will be good for the system. And also we're reviewing other audit recommendations for further study. We have also a major initiative is to create and revise administrative rules to address challenges presented by money match, which I touched on. Several that we've already dealt with is pooling of local governments for actuarial purposes. I believe there's a bill in the system currently to have the legislature look at the pooling process. It's very similar to an administrative rule that we're trying to adopt. See that as one way to address employer rates in the future. I think that's one way to stabilize employer rates in the future. We see that as a very useful tool. Earnings crediting adjustments to provide for even distribution between employers and member reserves is an action the board took last year, and I think we'll begin to bear some fruit soon in the system. And finally, Madam Chair, the overseeing ongoing employer / member litigation, which is a huge challenge for our Justice Department and Attorney General's representatives that represent the PERS board in those issues. They're very challenging in nature and have some serious implications for our system, maybe sometime before we're through that process and understand what effect that's going to have on the system. But that's one of our current initiatives. With that, Madam Chair, I don't have anything else to add. I would certainly entertain any questions that you may have. I'll try to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Holman. Representative Hayden.
Mr. Holman or Mr. Boyko, what is your statutory oversight committee?
I'll try to answer that, Chair Clarno, Representative Hayden. We haven't, up until this point, we haven't had an oversight committee per se, but I guess in this session now in the House, it'll be the House Rules Committee. Is that correct, Dallas? It'll be Chairman Wilson, Carl Wilson's committee. And in the Senate, I believe it's Senator Byer's committee, and we've already testified before that committee.
And the name of his committee is, I don't recall.
Is it Business and Labor?
To continue, Madam Chair. On page 4 and 8, you touch on the fact that that PERS adopts administrative rules and sets standards not defined in statutes in accordance with ORS 237, 238, 293. And on page 8, you say you create and revise administrative rules to address the challenges. Representative Wilson's committee on House Rules or Senator Byer's committee on business would come to you and say, we would like you to draft an administrative rule to meet the following goals, what would your response be?
Well, our first response would be to look to the statute to see if we were authorized to do so.
In accordance with statute.
The second thing is we would, are you asking a representative our typical process?
No, I'm saying that you on your own authority draft administrative rules. If your legislative oversight committee came to you and said, we would like you to draft an administrative rule to reach the following conclusion, the following goal, not telling you the words, not writing it for you, but say we want the following conclusions. What would your response be?
Chair Clarence, Representative Hayden, I guess I'm a little confused about the thrust. Is it to aid in the development of legislation, or?
No, it would be to aid in the guidance of the PERS agency.
Well, I think the first thing we would do is I would recommend to the board, first of all, the rulemaking authority is vested in the board, not in the staff. But my recommendation to the board would be to talk to DOJ about to what extent the legislature as a body needs to speak to us definitively about an area in which it has previously delegated us latitude to make rules with the general guidance that's in the opening parts of the statute, fair and effective administration and so on. I think the thrust of your general question is, do we look to a specific committee to direct us in the guidance of the execution of those more general rules? I guess my preference, and I can't speak for Chair Holman, is to have the legislature more broadly direct us, preferably through statute, if there's some specific thing that the legislature would like us to do. Again, I'm a little unclear about where you want me to take this issue.
Well,
I apologize
we're close,
for that.
Madam Chair, if I can continue, just to clarify it. You write administrative rule, and that's within your scope of practice. That's within your jurisdiction. Sometimes you may miss something, and your oversight committee will say, we think you've missed this particular point. We would like you to draft an administrative rule. This is not to say that you wouldn't be writing 95% of the administrative rules on your own authority, but House Rules or Senate Business might say, we think you've overlooked this, and we would like you to prepare an administrative rule to address this specific problem. We don't think it rises to the level of statute being necessary. We don't want to wait until the next legislative session. We would like it done now. We leave it to your discretion to find the words, but this is the conclusion. This is the result. We would like to see that administrative rule. Would that be within your authority to accept that guidance?
I would have to, Chair Clarno, Representative Hayden, this is a gray area in terms of having a part of the legislature direct rulemaking that the legislature as a whole has delegated to the board with some general instructions and guidelines. The first thing I'd do is I'd talk to DOJ about the nature of that communication and direction. But certainly anything that the legislature or any body within the legislature asks us to do, we would go ahead and do. The question is whether or not we would be keeping faith with the legislature as a whole if between sessions or within session we took direction from a subset of the legislature without an indication that that's what the legislature as a body wanted us to do. And this is a very, I'm out of my league in terms of correctly addressing the question that you're raising.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, I've kind of made a faux pas this morning. We need our little piggy out there, and I must warn you that Representative Butler started this process, and we have a little fine for things like DOJ. I think I let you get by with it twice, so Representative Butler didn't even catch that, I don't
know. And PERS stands for Public Employee Retirement System.
Yes.
So we'll give them that.
Sorry to bother you with that, Linda, but we must assess everybody's...
Facility people were getting freaked out by it.
Oh, a little too much money in there, and they're worried.
Madam Chair, I might mention that I have been duly warned.
Oh, you had been duly warned. Okay.
Madam Chair, I have a very short-term memory, so I'm just going to prepay and hopefully be done with it.
I see that's a big five, so I think you'd be paying for all week.
There you go.
The American Cancer Society will appreciate your prepaying your dues here. Okay, any further questions of Mr. Holman before we have Mr. Wojtko proceed with his presentation? If not, if you'd go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and share with us your overview.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Wojtko, and I'm the Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement System of Oregon. My task, as I best understand it today, is to go through the general programs and issues surrounding the Public Employees Retirement System and to give you a sense of the scope of our activities and some of the issues that we have in front of us that relate to either budgetary or programmatic questions. Let me begin with our mission. We have on our wall back at the agency in Tigard a mission statement that says to provide the highest quality services so that each member has an opportunity for a successful retirement. This is important because we do focus in all things that we do on our fiduciary activities and running the trust, and the trust has been put together by the legislature on the behalf of employers but for members who work at public employers. The three things that we do to try to put that mission statement into action is that we spend a lot of time exercising our fiduciary duty across a wide variety of decisions that we make, and to try to ensure the fiscal integrity of the retirement program so that adequate funds and necessary information are available when members retire and benefits are calculated according to law. I think it's important to note that there's two bodies of law that we look to. One is the Oregon statutes from yourselves, and the other is a body of common law, trustee law or fiduciary law, that we are bound to as well. The second thing is that we provide individual members as early as possible with the best and most consistent information available, and the reason is that they are asked a number of times over their public service career, and most particularly at time of retirement, to make choices that affect their financial outcomes. We have, I believe, 12 options that public employees face when they come to time of retirement in terms of how their benefit is structured. And these are important decisions about what may be the largest single financial asset that they have. And so we spend a substantial amount of time providing information in written form, verbal form, question and answers, emails, all sorts of things, counseling sessions, group sessions for the members. The third is that we provide employers who our members work for with accurate, timely data so that they too can make informed decisions. Because as you know, we charge rates to employers to fund the public pension system, and these sums of money are considerable and have an influence, as Chairman Holman, as a county commissioner, can tell you, on the budgeting and administration of local governments. Also, the way that the public employees retirement system is run has a significant effect on whether or not they can retain employees, and if so, how long. Also, they're faced with a large number of questions from their employees about retirement issues as well, and we try to assist them in that. I'm moving on to page 3. We have some general goals in terms of running the system. First of all, we are not a pay-as-you-go system. We try to be a fully funded system, and that's a very important distinction. We have as a goal that benefits in the system should be funded as they are earned, which means that we try to keep, from an actuarial point of view, the amount of money, just the right amount of money that's necessary in hand, so that the stream of benefits as it comes due, we have the right amount of money to pay those benefits over time. At the present time, we're 98% fully funded, which is quite good by comparison to other systems, and also a considerable improvement over recent years. But I will tell you that our job is never done in this respect, because the world is constantly changing, so that we go back and review the assumptions on which that financial report card is made. At least, actually by statute, we must do it every 2 years. The board has opted to actually go to every year currently because of the controversy surrounding the funding of the system, so that we're always working with the most up-to-date data.
Mr. Boyko, can I just interrupt you for just a moment there? A quick question regarding the funds, trying to maintain the funds on hand, sufficient amount to meet the payment obligation, desiring to keep the funded status at 100%, and you're 98% present. Can you give this committee the amount of the dollar amount of the unfunded 2%, what it amounts to?
I'm hard pressed to give you that number right off the top of my head, but I think we can definitely provide that to you. I just don't have the number at the tip of my tongue.
Okay.
It would be slightly in excess of $1 billion, but less than $2 billion, I believe.
More than $1 billion, but less than $2 billion.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
We also try to maintain stable contribution rates for employers. As you know, members have very stable contribution rates because their rate is set by statute at 6%. Keep in mind, and the board has just gone over its goals statement and revised it, updated it, and reconfirmed it. I think it's important to note that the actuarial sound funding of the public employees retirement system takes precedence over the stability of rates. Because our obligation under trustee law is always to the members whose benefits the system is supposed to guarantee. One of the things that Chairman Holman mentioned earlier is that one of our goals is to make sure that all accounts get credited evenly, unless there's some awfully good reason not to, when it comes time to distribute earnings from investments across various reserves, member, employee, or retiree. This has turned out to be extremely important recently because of the emergence of money match as the dominant calculation. And under money match, as you know, accounts grow over time, and they are the driver of benefit levels post-retirement. And treating the employer matching assets differently than the employee match assets creates, in essence, the potential for mismatch. And so, as Chairman Holman mentioned, last year the board moved to make sure that employer assets were treated identically with member assets, and this has been an important reform that the board has moved forward on. The last point is that I'd like to mention is that the board has continued to work on the issue of the gain loss reserve. The gain loss reserve exists to ensure that funds are available to meet the Tier 1 guarantee, to make sure that assets can be treated equally when earnings are credited, particularly in those years, as the recent year that just closed, where we earn less than the assumed rate in the plan, and therefore less than the guaranteed rate. This is a highly controversial area, and it is one of the areas where the staff is doing a substantial amount of work in order to help build new tools so that the board can make judgments about the appropriate amount of reserves with some indication about what the long-term consequences of putting more or less in the reserve actually are. Moving on to the next page, the statute asks us, it demands of us, a fair and efficient and effective administration of the system. I must say, as a newcomer to public government in Oregon, and having spent time in the East Coast in the public sector, I probably have never seen such an open system in my life. There are no secrets at PERS, that's for sure. Not only do we follow the rulemaking process as it's set forth in Oregon law, but we have, even below that, a system of what the board calls ad hoc committees, which they assemble very frequently, even prior to rulemaking, and bring stakeholder groups together in rather formal formats in order to vet issues and get information on the table so that the rulemaking process itself works better. And even below that, as we are having in these last couple of weeks, we often have informal meetings with stakeholders in order to decide whether or not the ad hoc process is necessary. So I must say that again, commenting as somebody new to the system, I don't think I've ever seen a more open process that I've seen here in Oregon. We also review and comment on all legislation affecting the financial stability of the fund or the ability to administer the system. I think it's important to note that neither the board in its policy and goal statement nor the staff takes any advocacy positions on the level of benefits. However, we will be advocates and commentators on issues that affect the administration of the system, which is why you hear so much from us about our technological capability or lack thereof, because we think it's critical to the fair, efficient, and effective administration of the trust. The last point is that we perform accurate and timely record keeping of all pension accounts for members over their careers and for employers in perpetuity. If anything, PERS is a gigantic record keeping machine, if you will, and in the process, we create huge numbers of accounts, because we have accounts both for people who used to be in the public service and are no longer, people who are still in the public service, retirees, and we'll talk about the membership growth over time. Page 5 shows you an org chart of our agency. We're not a very big agency, about 215 FTE at present, with some temps brought on from time to time to do specific tasks and workload surges. There are certain areas like health insurance program or the Oregon Growth Savings Growth Program, which we'll talk about, where we outsource substantial amounts of our activities to public sector entities through contract. If you turn to page 6, you can see those areas of the org chart that are affected by changed in any way from past years by our proposed budget, and we'll be going into those in detail. We'll be talking today particularly about the shaded positions on the far left-hand side, risk management positions, again, something that we do feel strongly about, and we'll be talking about our shortcomings in the internal audit area, and I'll give you some statistics that'll give you a flavor for that. Page 7, I mentioned earlier that we spend a good deal of time talking with our members to help them make some of the critical lifetime decisions they make with regard to their pension assets. We do a variety of things from member education through materials, through answering phone calls, and through counseling, both in groups, more often in groups these days because we've made a specific effort to do so, but also individual counseling. We have a wide slate of publications and communications that we use for members, and by the way, also for employers, I might add. We have a very large volume of telephone calls that are incoming to the agency. We've tried to work that down by doing more group counseling, more work with our publication materials to try to short-circuit calls, because calls are very labor-intensive. We've also gone to using email and tried to have members do more self-service through the website, and that is having some effect. We also administer the deferred compensation program. Again, there we rely a great deal on our third-party administrator to do a lot of the heavy lifting for us. And we do member estimates, and this is probably something that has become more popular over time and more demanding of us as the program has become more complex. If I could turn to page 8 for a moment. This is an extremely important part of the agency, because this is the part that in essence runs the record keeping portion of the agency. It also does the calculations that that determine benefit levels, and also qualifications for certain types of treatment. Just to give you a sense, we have a matrix program in the sense that we have many different kinds of members. Some are listed here: judges, police officers, firefighters, general service members, disabilitants, which are treated differently, which under statute are guaranteed different treatment. And on top of that, we also have concurrent methodologies for calculating benefits. And as we'll talk about later and perhaps tomorrow, we're rated by outside benchmarking agencies as having one of the more complex plans in public retirement plans in the nation. We also do much of the same thing for employers, and this is not as well known as the work we do with members, but we have over 800 employers. Each one of those also has a great deal of traffic in and out of the agency in terms of asking questions about employee qualification, how payroll is treated, and also helping them answer questions that they get from their own employees about the retirement system. If I could move on to page 9 for a moment, we talk about the Fiscal Services Division. We talked about customer service. We talked about the processing and data quality division. The Fiscal Services Division is in many ways the Chief Financial Officer's division in the agency. It has a very wide array of responsibilities and touches almost all parts of the agency. It also happens to oversee our building management and our physical assets, which are not large by state agency standards. But there are some things that I would also mention that aren't on here. It also is the point area for coordinating with the Audits Division. We get audited on a regular basis from a financial point of view by the Audits Division. In fact, we just recently completed a financial audit and got a good report card. We also have had them work with the Information Technology Division in working with the Audits Division when they come in to look at our systems. The other thing that isn't mentioned on here that is a tremendous amount of work is the earnings crediting that happens annually. Once each year, the fund's earnings are taken and distributed across accounts, member accounts, and employer accounts as well. This is an extremely sensitive issue, as you can imagine, and accuracy is of the utmost order, is really needed. Because one of the things that we've learned painfully over time is that if you don't do it right the first time, you'll do it a second time, and you have cut your productivity in half when you make errors the first time through. We'd also mention that you see down below in the last bullet point the Benefit Equalization Fund. This is a new and growing area of the agency. The Internal Revenue Code 415 basically says that once benefits have reached a certain level and begin to exceed that level, they're no longer tax qualified. And yet under Oregon law, under the statutes presented to us by the legislature and by rulings of the Supreme Court, those benefits are still due to the members. But they can't be continued to operate within a tax qualified plan. So to protect the systems tax qualification as a whole, we've had to create a new trust off to the side that in essence delivers the promised benefit, but from a sidebar, non-qualified plan to make sure that we fulfill our obligation to the member, but don't endanger the tax qualification of the plan as a whole.
So when was that side benefit fund created, and how is it administered differently than the...
Representative Butler? 1997, the staff informs me.
1997, and it has, now does it have to be as a, again, that's the unqualified or non-qualified pension benefit. What's the name of it?
It's the Benefit Equalization Fund, and it also is a trust fund. The numbers of members are not large relative to our membership, Representative Butler, but it is growing, and part of the reason that it's more work than a larger number of individuals within the traditional plan is that our systems were never built to automate the Benefit Equalization Fund or a non-qualified plan. So almost all of this work has to be done manually.
So in addition to the current computerized system that you're operating under, the amounts are then shifted over to the the non-qualified benefit equalization fund. And does it operate, it's a fiduciary account, I understand. Does it operate in much the same fashion as Chair Holman, the chair of that benefit fund as well?
Absolutely. All of these trust funds tree up from a fiduciary responsibility point of view through myself and to the Board of Trustees.
So at that particular point, even though it's not a portion of the PERS technically, it really is a portion of the PERS, but it's the unqualified or non-qualified, non-recognized portion for the Internal Revenue Service.
That's correct, Representative Butler. It is part of the Public Employees Retirement System, but its tax treatment, it has to be segregated in order to maintain the correct tax treatment for the bulk of the plan. And
because it's non-qualified, what are the penalties or what are the treatments of it under the tax code that may be different than the PERS's regular treatment?
You've exceeded my technical capability in the tax code area, Representative Butler, but we could get you a written response to the differences between the qualified and the non-qualified plan from an Internal Revenue Code treatment point of view. If you'd like, we could deliver that tomorrow to you.
I would appreciate that, because there must be some, obviously because of the non-qualified nature of that plan, there must be, and the necessity of segregating its resources. It would have to come under some different tax treatment by its very nature.
That is correct, and I must say, from my experience in the private sector, having a non-qualified plan alongside a qualified plan is not unusual. It happens. I don't know frequently, but I've seen it happen at every private sector firm that I've worked in. Of course, I've worked in big ones.
Okay, thank you.
If we could move on to page 10, if that's your pleasure, we could talk a little bit about the Information Services Division. This is the part of the agency that is the engine room, if you will, provides all our data processing and telecommunications capabilities for the agency. And this ranges from the hardware and software from our local area network, our telephone system, and recall that we rely on our telephone system not just for incoming and outgoing communications with employers and members, but it is also our link to the IRMD mainframe on which our software resides here in Salem. So our telephone links are critical to our ability to do business day in and day out. We also have a very large portfolio, if you will, of software. That's what the RIM system is. The RIM system is not really hardware or a computer per se. It's a very large body of software that does the unique calculations that are unique to the Oregon pension system, as well as the ones that are generic to all pension systems. This part of the agency also does our record management and coordinates with the Treasury Department on our pension roll, that is the monthly distribution of benefits to retirees. Works with the Treasury on direct deposit. We've worked very hard to try to get as many of our members on direct deposit as we can. And we'd like to do more on employer electronic funds transfer. Unfortunately, the RIM system is really not capable of handling electronic funds transfer directly from employers. On page 11, we come to the executive services area. This is an area that has a very wide and disparate set of activities. One of them is government and legislative relations. And this involves interaction with substantive committees that I was questioned on earlier, but also can work with DAS and other the governor's office on whatever issues they may have. It also handles, this is the where we have the sole person involved in internal audit and risk management is housed in this section. Our health insurance programs, including retiree health, retiree medical, and now a new program, long-term care, long-term disability, are housed in this part of the agency and run out of our Salem office. The personnel department is in this group. We also do performance metrics measured in this area, And we do conduct our responsibilities for working with the federal government in the area of Social Security out of this section of the agency.
I'll stop you right there if you don't mind. I usually take a break at 9:30 for the committee, and we'll be back in 5 minutes. Thank you.